I vividly remember when I first heard the words Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The year was 1930 and I was 7. Together with my second grade classmates, I'd been herded into a capacious study hall in a New York City public school where a Board of Education honcho had come to call. We had no sooner settled in our seats than this forbidding presence popped a question. What is the first name of the Roosevelt who is our governor and who is being talked about as the next president of the United States? Silence. Then one youngster piped up, Theodore. The stranger shook his head grumpily, no. Then came a rain of wild guesses while he stood there glowering. Finally, he told us the answer. It was one, I said to myself on that tense occasion, I had better commit to memory. But little did I realize that morning how the phrase Franklin Delano Roosevelt would accompany me all the rest of my days.
Historian William Luchtenberg, for Roosevelt History Month, he's here to talk about the life and legacy of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light. We keep the lights on and more. By presidential declaration, October 1996 is Roosevelt History Month, the first to be so named in the nation's history. To remember FDR, join me now for a conversation with one of America's most distinguished historians. William Luchtenberg is here to talk about the life and legacy of FDR, subjects that have occupied him professionally and personally for nearly 50 years. William Luchtenberg teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and at Duke University. The recipient of both the Bancroft and Parkman Prizes, he's a past president of the American Historical Association and the Organization of American Historians. Among his recent books are The FDR Years and The Supreme Court Reborn. Bill Luchtenberg begins with a story about the 1930s, the Supreme Court, and sick chickens.
Roosevelt comes to power in March of 1933, with some 15 million unemployed, most of the banks closed, the stock market shut down, and he puts through in the first 100 days of 1933 some of the most unusual, dramatic legislation in all our history. One of the keystones of the New Deal, as his program was called, was the National Industrial Recovery Act that provided for industrial mobilization and the right of workers to form unions. In 1935, in a case involving the kosher poultry business in Brooklyn, which, among other things, was involved in the selling of diseased chickens, and hence the name the sick chicken case, in the Schechter case, the Supreme Court, 9-0, struck down that National Industrial Recovery Act. And this was in part because there had never before been such a degree of intervention by the national government into the economy.
Uh-huh.
To take a single instance, at the time Roosevelt comes to power, there are no old age pensions in the country. There is no unemployment compensation program. There is no aid to dependent children on the part of the national government.
Uh-huh.
From the time that the Social Security Act of 1935 was enacted to the present day, the federal government has handed out $1 trillion in benefits to the American people. That is a change not just in degree, but in kind.
Now, FDR went through this series of reversals over his New Deal legislation, and yet what appears to be the end of the New Deal, as it is aborning, eventually has a reversal of fortunes. We come to, what is it, about the late 1930s, and somehow or other the court, in effect, by the nod of a single justice's head, do I have this story right, revises the Constitution. Now, give us the details here.
That's essentially right, what you've just said, Wayne. In 1937, February 5th of 1937, Roosevelt has just been returned to office by the greatest landslide in the history of the two-party system. He carries all but two of the then 48 states. And the country waits for some weeks wondering what he's going to do with this tremendous victory. And he startles the country early in that first week of February by calling on Congress to enact a law permitting him to name as many as six new justices to the Supreme Court.
Now, before in the history of our nation, we had had what, six, nine, a maximum of what?
Well, there had never been more than nine, but the numbers had varied over time, and there is an argument that that there was a precedent in Grant's administration, although most historians no longer accept that.
So here comes FDR. The harsh way to describe it is he's trying to pack the court.
That was what Herbert Hoover is. The man he defeated in 1932 called it the very first day the court packing plan, and it never has lost that name. Roosevelt said that what he was trying to do was improve the efficiency of the course of the court by replacing these elderly justices or giving them additional help by adding new younger justices, bringing fresh blood to the court.
Now, should we buy this argument?
Well, it was, I think, clear to almost everybody at the time that what he wanted to do, although to a degree he believed that, was to get justices on the court who would be more sympathetic to the New Deal experimental legislation that he was putting through.
He called them the nine old men. Called them.
Yeah, that's right. That phrase is often attributed to Roosevelt. Actually, it comes from two well-known newspaper columnists of the time, Drew Pearson and Robert Allen, who did a series of columns and then a book by that name. They're the predecessors of the later columnist Jack Anderson.
Now, did FDR and this encounter that he had with the Supreme Court, was that a sea change in our legislative and social and judicial history? To what degree do we look back at that and say, this is a moment that helps to shape modern American industrial society?
From that day to this, from the change of the Supreme Court in 1937, you were asking earlier about that nod of the head.
Right.
There were some of these cases had been decided by votes of 5-4, notably a decision in June of 1936 striking down the New York minimum wage law. And in the spring of 1937, by 5-4, the Supreme Court upholds a minimum wage law from the state of Washington, and the result comes from the change of mind of a single justice, Owen Roberts. And once he's changed in that case, he votes 5-4 to uphold the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, and then there are two decisions upholding the Social Security Act. From that day to this, the Supreme Court has never struck down any important piece of economic legislation, regulation of the economy, control of business. Just in the past year, in a case involving whether the Congress may control the right of a high school student to bring a gun into a Texas school, the Supreme Court surprised the country by striking down that law, although it made clear that this was probably not a departure, not an attempt to return to those pre-1937 days. The jury's still out on that, though.
Fair enough. Bill Luchtenberg, we're talking about your books on FDR, the Supreme Court, the New Deal. Let's look back and really take the long view here. How would you characterize the achievements and the drawbacks of the New Deal? I mean, we're assuming here that it is the shaping moment or one of the principal shaping moments in our modern American society. How do you take the measure of the highs and lows?
Well, I do think you're right that this is a shaping moment, that this is the great divide in the history of the 20th century. We have the birth of the welfare state with notably with the Social Security Act. We have massive federal relief to the unemployed, including imaginative programs like the Federal Arts Program, Federal Writers Project, that provide the basis for the later National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Before the 1930s, The United States was alone in the industrialized world in that almost no worker in a factory belonged to a union. At the end of the Roosevelt period, the great industries, auto, rubber, textiles, are all organized by unions. Before the 1930s, the federal government did very little to subsidize the farmer. After the 1930s, the novelist William Faulkner later said, we no longer farm in cotton fields, we farm in congressional corridors. So the whole nature of the agricultural economy has been changed.
Right.
American politics was notably altered by the realignment of the 1930s, the creation of the FDR coalition.
Did it go far enough? As I understand it, one of the sort of hot topics that you share and argue with and agree with your colleagues in the in professional history is the question of did the New Deal, was it sufficient unto the day? How about that?
Well, there's a whole school of historians associated with the New Left who argue that Roosevelt missed an opportunity, in essence, to socialize the country, to nationalize the banks. I don't believe that was something that Roosevelt ever really wanted to do, or that that the country wanted him to do. That having been said, I do think that there were areas that were left undone, notably on the subject of providing for health insurance. The Social Security Act was limited in not doing that. But the New Deal set a pattern that later presidents could follow. And in the Fair Deal of Harry Truman, in the Great Society and War on Poverty of Lyndon Johnson, built on those New Deal precedents to provide Medicare and Medicaid and federal aid to education and legislation of that nature.
Bill, let's remember FDR more or less at a personal level. I mean, here you have spent many years studying this man, writing about him. Mm-hmm. Just recently, last December, the Senate votes unanimously to encourage the country to honor the memory of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and yet what I'm inviting from you here is the range of controversy that still surrounds the man. How do we figure out whether we're remembering an individual politician or a sort of political legacy when we carry on these debates about FDR?
Well, there were aspects of Roosevelt that were unique. He was, to begin with, the only president to have served more than two terms. He was elected to a third term, then a fourth term. He served only a part of that. And ironically, shortly after he died, Congress, as a kind of posthumous act of vengeance, put through a two-term amendment, which means that Roosevelt, in all likelihood, will be the only president of all time to have been in the White House for that long. I think when people remember him, they're thinking of two things. One, they think of him as the man who led the country through the Great Depression, who inaugurated the welfare state, and who led the country through a successful war against the fascist powers, and that finally led to the creation of the United Nations and the post-war structure of international arrangements and for peace. But also, I think they remember the courage of this man, a man in a wheelchair, though most of the country didn't realize that, a man of extraordinary self-confidence. Someone once said of him that he appeared to have been psychoanalyzed by God. George Will said on another occasion that he was like the fairy prince who didn't know how to shiver. He could fill the country with that ebullience, with that with that self-confidence.
Right.
You can do it too.
How should we remember him, Bill Luchtenberg? There's a controversy. Here we are celebrating, honoring President Roosevelt, October of 1996. There is debate about whether we should. Is it trivializing politics and historical memory to argue about the cigarette holder and whether the people today of America should see this man sitting in a wheelchair? There's what is it, one photograph out of 130,000 photographs that show him sitting in that wheelchair? Give us a take on this. PC, revisionism, what's going on?
I lived all through the Roosevelt years. I was a child of about 10 when he first took office. And so all of the years of my political consciousness were formed with Roosevelt in the White House. And the greatest shock that I have ever had in reading a book came when I was well into my 20s, when I was reading John Gunther's Inside Roosevelt, and I was told in Gunther's book that all through that time, Roosevelt was a man in a wheelchair. We'd all known, of course, that he had had polio, but the cartoons of the day show him as a man on a flying trapeze, as a lion tamer, taming lions, bounding about. Most of us had no idea that this was so. And that does create a problem for the people constructing this memorial. Uh-huh. As it happens, I was approached at the very outset by the creator of the memorial, Lawrence Halperin, to provide the quotations that are being used there. So I followed this all along. I have some sympathy with those who don't put him in a wheelchair because that is not the way he was perceived at the time. And yet, on reflection, I do think there are there's more than one place for him there. They have four different rooms for each of the terms. I do think, particularly since he himself, when he returned from Yalta, referred to those steel braces that he was carrying on his head, the only time he ever did in public make such a reference, that in that memorial there ought to be a place to show Roosevelt seated and show him with the braces on.
And you say, Bill, that you helped to pick the quotations for the FDR Memorial. Whether it's a good truth or a bad truth, the truth is that this country revolves around images,
yes.
Television particularly. Should we see the president holding a cigarette holder? Should we look at Mrs. Roosevelt wearing a fur stole at the risk of invoking the wrath of the animal rights people? Again, this sounds like a trivial argument, and yet it goes to the question of our unity and our fragmentation as a people. How about it?
Well, I think this cuts in exactly the opposite direction as the question about the wheelchair, because to not show him in a wheelchair would be not showing him the way he actually was as president, however he was perceived as right. as being. To take that fur stole away from Eleanor, to take the cigarette holder in which Roosevelt gestured with his camel cigarette is actually a distortion of history. In 1936, when FDR hears the first returns come in from New Haven, it has been predicted that he's going to be defeated by the leading poll of the day. Roosevelt leans back, blows a huge smoke ring out from that cigarette holder and says, "Wow," because he knows it's the start of a landslide victory. Now, you just can't take that away. That's part of the reality of FDR.
Right. What's the story? Some little kid asked him, "Why do you smoke?" or "Why do you use a cigarette holder?" And his response was the advice of a physician. What was that line?
I thought I'd heard every story, Wayne, about FDR.
I think it's the one about the doctor told me to stay as far away as I could from cigarettes.
That's right. Well, I'm grateful for yet another FDR yarn.
Now, Bill, you just mentioned polls and polling. Let's talk about FDR in the context of how the presidency has changed. I mean, this is an enormous, unmanageable topic, I suppose. But from your perspective as a historian of the modern American presidency, what are the big changes that have occurred in the way the people look at the president and the traffic between the president and the people?
Well, there once was a time when the White House seemed very remote from the American people. A president earlier in the century, like William Howard Taft, would get perhaps a couple of hundred letters a week only. When Roosevelt delivered his electrifying first inaugural address, the American people took the trouble to send him nearly 500,000 letters.
Now, when you say delivered, are we talking about the means of delivery that accounts for this shift?
Yes, that this came to people seated around radio loudspeakers across the country. Roosevelt understood this. This is the importance of his fireside chat. Until Roosevelt, most politicians spoke to the radio insofar as they did at all, because it was a fairly new invention. KDKA Pittsburgh did the first World Series report as recently as 1920, only 12 years before Roosevelt was elected president. These politicians would orate as though they were talking to an audience of a thousand.
This is the 19th century at work.
19th century, yes, carryover.
Not the 20th.
And Roosevelt understood that he was talking to people, as he thought of it, seated around their fireside, just a group of one or two or three or four people. And he would talk to them intimately in his very first fireside chat in March of 1933. He started out with what became the familiar salutation, "My friends,"
right,
and said, "I want to talk tonight about to the people about banking." And afterwards, the comedian Will Rogers said that he made banking and the banking crisis so understandable that even a banker could now understand it.
Bill Luchtenberg, we're talking about your scholarship about FDR, the FDR years, and the Supreme Court Reborn, two of your new books. Let's talk about presidential scholarship, not to become too arcane or dusty here, but that is, after all, your life's work. How has that changed since you did your, I think, what is it, 63, you wrote the book about FDR and the New Deal?
That's correct.
Okay, so we're looking back, you know, here more than 30 years. How has all of that changed?
Well, actually, the very first book that I wrote about the Roosevelt period is that runaway bestseller, Flood Control Politics, the Connecticut River Valley Problem, which I'm sure all your listeners vividly remember. That goes back even to the early 1950s. So right. I first went to Hyde Park over 45 years ago, and that was unique. I remember there was one other historian in the room, James McGregor Burns, then writing his Roosevelt, the Lion and the Fox. And we had an advantage that earlier generations had never had before. Almost all of the White House files, they're accessible to us, millions and millions of pieces of paper,
and that's
beautifully
not,
organized. And,
that's not the case today?
It continues to be, but this was the start of it.
I see.
And the Lyndon Johnson Library, for example, where I've also worked, has 35 to 40 million pieces of paper.
So it's the sheer numbers. It's the weight, the mass of what's available to scholars.
And the very early accessibility of it. I've worked in the Jimmy Carter Library. There, I've students who are already going through the Nixon and the Reagan materials. Nowhere else in the world is so much available so soon.
Bill, a quick footnote to our conversation, a favorite FDR story. Can't let you get away without sharing that with us. How about it?
Fine, Wayne. Well, one of the main criticisms delivered at the time about Franklin Roosevelt was that he could not be trusted, that he was a man who didn't keep his word. Herbert Hoover said of him that he was a chameleon on plaid. It takes you for a second to realize what a wicked statement that is. And in particular, it was pointed out that Roosevelt in 1932 had run on a platform of balancing the budget and of denouncing the incumbent, Herbert Hoover, as being the greatest spending president in peacetime in all our history, piling bureau on bureau, commission on commission.
Right.
It was to sound like an anti-Roosevelt speech just a few months later. In 1936, he returned to Forbes Field in Pittsburgh, where he'd made that speech. That was then the home of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And he said to his speechwriter, Sam Rosenman, that he needed to allude to that speech, but he wanted Sam to provide him a consistent explanation of how he'd behaved. and Rosenman came in sometime later, and he said, "Mr. President, I think that I have it." And he said that Roosevelt seemed surprised but pleased that there was an answer. And Rosenman then said to President Roosevelt, the answer is deny you ever were in Pittsburgh in 1932.
Bill, what a great pleasure to listen to you talk about a subject that is so near and dear to your professional and personal heart, Franklin D. Roosevelt. You are William Luchtenberg, a Keenan Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Two new books here, The FDR Years, available from Columbia, and The Supreme Court Reborn, available from Oxford University Press. Bill, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I certainly wish you well as you continue your work.
Oh, thanks very much, Wayne. I've greatly enjoyed it.
You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was historian William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Duke University. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light. We keep the lights on and more. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program.
Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. All together shout it now. There's no one who can doubt it now. So let's tell the world about it now. Happy days are here again. Your cares and troubles are gone. There'll be no more from now on. Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Audio tapes are available for $10 post-paid. Write to us with your comments or for a tape. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 836. That's $10, program number 836. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, new fiction from writer Roxana Robinson. Her stories have been called masterful, elegant, and tender. Roxana Robinson writes about the old moneyed inhabitants of Manhattan, Connecticut, Long Island, and Maine. But her characters are both contemporary and rendered in a style at once sympathetic and honest. Asking for Love, new fiction from Roxana Robinson, next week on Soundings. Until next week's show, thanks for listening. I'm Wayne Pond. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.